Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball, and thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can get more from Milk Street by following us on Instagram at 177 Milk Street. There you can find free recipes, cooking tips, videos from our world travel, plus much more. That's Instagram at 177 Milk Street. Now, please enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX, and I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. So, what do you feed your pet? Maybe some kibble and some wet food, or maybe leftover burgers as a treat? On TikTok, Sean McDonald cooks gourmet food for his pet.
Tasting menu dish 3 for my baby puppy, Hazelnut.
Hazel, ready for more food?
Hazelnut obviously has a refined palate, but she also loves modern minimalistic art, so I'm going to try to incorporate that into today's dish.
Good girl.
When Sean, a restaurant chef, cooks at home for his chocolate lab Hazelnut, he doesn't use any seasoning or salt, but he does think about technique and the best ingredients.
I did Tornado Rossini once, which is like beef bordelaise sauce, which is like a bone marrow jus, foie gras. I put a little bit of truffle on there. And then on like a piece of sourdough, I did prawn with the celery in the prawn broth. I did puppy friendly sushi, so I put all these like weird things on sushi. I did like some traditional sushi, but I also did some where it was like duck liver, chicken heart, like all these dog friendly kind of raw foods.
Like many restaurant chefs, Sean says he doesn't really cook for himself, but he'll always cook for Hazelnut.
Always, of course. I remember saying it before I got her. I was like, I'm gonna feed her. She's gonna be the best fed dog ever on the planet. I want her to eat the tastiest food, even though everything probably tastes the same to her because she's a dog.
That was Sean McDonald. You can find him on Instagram at ShawneeMacD. To help tell the story of cooking for pets, I'm joined now by journalist Alex Beggs. Her article for Taste is called Bon Appetit, the short and happy history of cookbooks for dogs. Alex, welcome to Milk Street.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here's my question. Before dog food, before cookbooks for dogs, you know, what did people feed their dogs like 100 years ago?
My understanding is that people fed their dogs the cheapest possible meat they could find.
Okay, that makes sense. But then just after the First World War, you could actually go out and buy commercial dog food. And then eventually a few people had this great idea, you know, why not do a cookbook for dogs? When did that happen and why did it happen?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised it took until the mid-60s to have a cookbook for dogs. The first book that I was able to track down was Barton Gartner's book, The Secret of Cooking for Dogs, and he also did The Secret of Cooking for Cats. And I tracked him down to talk about it to confirm, yours was the first book, right? And he said, yes. That was the whole reason he did it. He went to the library. He made sure it hadn't been done before. That was very important for him to be trailblazing. And so his is the first, and it's absolutely delightful.
And this comes hard on the heels of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. So,
yes.
Just a few years before, yes.
I don't know if they have much in common, but I'd like to think I could find something if I had to.
Well, I love MFK Fisher. She wrote, a review of the cat book.
Yes, of both books. Yeah. In the New Yorker, of all things. No pet cookbook has been reviewed in the New Yorker since.
No, she has this great quote. Mr. Gardner assumes the cats will eat soup. I've been trying to prove this for 50 years with no luck at all, and even his persuasive hints about it do not convince me. So she had some fun with this notion of, you know, cooking for your pet.
Yes, and there's a fabulous picture, I don't know if you've seen, with her. It's a black and white photo, and she's holding her cat almost up to her face.
No, I have not seen that.
Big cat lady.
So the chapters, you know, hooray for filet, soup's on, pregnant paws, senior citizens. Was this all just tongue-in-cheek, or were any of these recipes things that people might actually make for their dog or cat?
They were very legit. Martin told me the recipes were from his friends who had dogs and from some vets, and they're very simple, blended up liver and cottage cheese and things like that. So it seems like easy enough to be realistic to do, and that there's always an audience out there who's willing to try it.
Then this trend continues. My favorite title, Bon Appetit, from Susan Anson in 1989. But by this time, things are getting weird. I mean, this isn't just like, you know, mix up some liverwurst. This is canine carbonara. Yeah, bacon, ziti, peas, onions, mushrooms, parmesan, and anchovy fillets. A delicacy for dogs, quote, who go wild over the fish aroma. And in that book, Bon Appetit, there's a recipe for golden skin elixir, which I think is a is a category of sort of medicinal dog foods. Is that something that sort of runs through these books too?
Definitely. I'd say most people who start cooking for their dogs are usually doing it out of medical necessity. The author Rick Woodford, whose books sell really well, have a health focus, and he told me that his dog had cancer and he started cooking for it, and the dog lived another 4 years and was healthier than ever. So yeah, they all kind of start with a medical seeming necessity and then become a fun hobby that people want to share with others.
So I read with some shock and amusement that Judith Jones, who I knew a little bit back in the 80s, who edited Julia Child's Mastering of French Cooking, among other books, she did a cookbook for dogs.
Yes, and that was the genesis of this story. My editors at Taste came across Judith Jones' book, which is called Love Me, Feed Me, Sharing with Your Dog the Everyday Good Food You Cook and Enjoy.
There's also, though, a line that gets crossed here. And if you go back to Judith Jones in her cookbook for dogs, mentions that her dog has a taste for Gorgonzola Dolce. So, look, I can understand if you think your dog deserves more than canned or dry dog food. But Gorgonzola Dolce, I mean, is that crossing a line?
I'm not going to be the dog food line cross police. I think it's all wonderful. But I'm thinking about how the dog cookbook authors I spoke to, I would say, what was your dog's favorite recipe? Or what did they like? What did they not like? You know, as if it's a kid who doesn't eat cauliflower. And they almost all said my dog does not have a discerning palate. They'll eat whatever's in front of them. So you start to think about, you know, why are you doing this? Are you doing this for the dog, or are you doing this for a feeling that it sparks inside you? And if so, what is that feeling?
When you did research for this article, did you get a sense of where the world of dog food stands today? In other words, I know that dog food has become a gourmet category now, right? Is dog food viewed as something that people don't like feeding their dogs anymore, or has the world changed in dog food so you can get really high quality food?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's interesting how it mirrors our current human skepticism with some things in the food world. So Rick Woodford's books, for example, he talks about, you know, you don't want all this processed stuff in your dog's food. I'm giving you options, in the way that we have people at the grocery store who are scared of buying Cheetos because of all the processed ingredients that may be in them to preserve them. So I think those anxieties that we have over our own food kind of reflect over in the dog food world too.
Were there recipes, we mentioned a few, were there recipes in any of these books that really stood out to you as either being actually quite reasonable or being totally insane or something else?
Well, some of the like sardines on toast in Martin Gardner's book from the 60s sounded like nice little crostinis to me. But Judith Jones, you know, she made moussaka for her dog, like beautiful red lentils, asparagus and mushroom risotto. One was a pizza recipe for a dog, and I asked the author, how does a dog eat pizza? You know, he doesn't have opposable thumbs. She said, well, I kind of had to hold it there while he's eating it, and I really liked that image.
So is this really a big trend, cooking for your pet? And after you finish your article, do you have a better understanding of why people, you know, go to all these lengths?
Well, as far as is this a thing a lot of people do? No, this is an extremely niche hobby, but one thing I was thinking about as far as like society and this moment in time we're in and what it all means, what does dog cooking for your dog mean about humanity? Have you ever read about this happiness course at Yale?
No, I missed that one.
So it's this class at Yale that anyone can take now about how to be happy. And it's based on a lot of evidence about what makes people happy. And one of those things is taking care of people and taking care of others, and recognizing your own act of kindness can boost your own happiness. So I think it's coming from a place of, to me, very beautiful, outsized devotion and love for this other being. And it's not a human being, and that's fine. It's coming from a place of feeling like you did something selfless for someone else today, and that boosts your happiness, and maybe theirs too, especially if you cooked the turkey pate right. However, I don't cook for my cat, so I just kind of feel like a jerk.
But here's what I like. There's this idea of why are people cooking more for dogs than cats? But I think you were quoted as saying, we don't even bathe cats, so why would you cook for them? So
yeah.
I guess there is, now cat lovers are going to send thousands of emails to Milk Street. But I take the point. Alex, thank you so much. Now I have a new project, do a cookbook for pets. Thank you.
Lots yet to do. Thank you for having me.
That was Alex Beggs, author of the Taste article, Bon Appetit, the short and happy history of cookbooks for dogs. Next up is time to answer some of your cooking questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah is, of course, the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on Public Television, also author of Home Cooking 101.
Well, hello, Chris. How the heck are you?
I'm good.
Good. What is your favorite way to eat an egg?
I mean, for breakfast?
Yeah.
Let me count the ways.
Count them.
I love poaching them, and I use poaching cups, the little metal thing that sits on the side of your pot.
Whoa.
You spray it or oil it, put the egg on, it goes down, sits above the water, put the top on, and you essentially steam it. Works perfectly every time. That's great. I do scrambled eggs using hot olive oil instead of butter. It's a Spanish technique. They cook really fast, and they fluff right up because oil's hotter than butter, because butter has water in it,
right,
of course. And fried eggs, I like them crispy.
Around the edges.
And I don't want this soft. I like some real crisp to it. Those would be my three go-to.
Yeah.
And you?
Oh, geez, I almost never met an egg I didn't like cooked almost anyway. But I'd say fried is right up there.
Yeah, fried's good.
You know, because I like runny yolks. I see them as part of the sauce, whatever. So I'll throw it on top of a sandwich or put it over some
noodles,
soup, a stew. And then it just becomes part of the...
It's my go-to cheat for dinner.
Yummy.
And one last thing is za'atar, the spice mix with the herb and the sesame seeds and the sumac.
Yeah.
Really goes well on eggs.
Oh, you know, I haven't tried that.
Or Aleppo pepper or, you know, the red chili.
Yes.
Also goes really well on eggs.
Okay. So eggs. Love eggs. Yes.
A message from the egg board.
Right. Well, let's take our call.
Okay.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hello, this is James calling from Salt Lake City.
Hi, James. How can we help you today?
My fiance and I are getting married next month, and we are moving into a new house. We've got our first kitchen that we're outfitting together.
How exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting. Thank you. We're wondering if you have any tips of tools or equipment or ingredients we should add to our new kitchen.
Well, do you have the basics?
Yes, we cook quite a lot already, so maybe just things that are basics in your kitchen, but might not be basics in my kitchen.
All right. I love gadgets. I'm sort of a gadget nerd, but they have to be useful. So, one thing I love is my Spetzel maker. They are pretty cheap, and they're really great. They're not electric, and it's fresh pasta. It looks like a washboard that you put over, a plank, and you go back and forth. So that's really easy. My favorite, and this is really silly, and you may already have one, is what's referred to as a giant cake lifter. It looks like a giant bench scraper metal, and it's supposed to be used to lift cakes. And, yeah, it does that pretty well, but it also moves massive amounts of chopped vegetable from your cutting board to your sheet pan. So I love that. I use it for everything. Another thing I've discovered, because I grind my own beans for my coffee, so I do a burr grinder instead of a coffee grinder. And I want to mention an ingredient that I also discovered from Milk Street, garlic confit. Okay, Chris?
Here's some really weird things. In Japan, they use drop lids. They're often made of wood, but they also have them of metal. When you're cooking vegetables, steaming or boiling them, it fits inside the saucepan and keeps everything cooking evenly, which is nice. There's a cutting board called the Hasegawa, H-A-S-E-G-A-W-A, and they're very expensive. They're like $120, but it's the best cutting board. It will not warp. It has sort of a cushioned surface. It's just great on your knives. It's a pleasure to use. It's heavy. It's terrific. There's a ginger grater called the Moha, M-O-H-A. It's a brown metal, fairly cheaply made, maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter. The top is rounded, concave with little holes in it. And you can move the ginger around in any direction instead of going in one direction. And it grates really fast. And then underneath, as you turn the top opens from the bottom. It has a little windshield wiper. So it cleans off the underside of the grater. It's just amazing. I wouldn't say it's a work of art, but it works really well. A small offset spatula, maybe 5 inches long, 4 inches long. And it's good for taking cake batter, even in a bundt pan where you don't have a lot of room to maneuver. And evening the top, it's absolutely essential. And finally, Aleppo pepper is my new favorite ingredient. It's not harvested in Syria anymore, but in Turkey. It's a red, very fruity pepper. It's not too hot. And I basically have given up black peppercorns mostly now and use that. Oh, one last thing. There's a bread knife out of Japan called a Seseragi, S-E-S-E-R-A-G-I. That has 3 different kinds of serrations on it, and it's not very heavy, has a great wooden handle, and it is amazing, the best bread knife I've ever used. So, wow.
These are all great gift ideas for a wedding registry, right?
Yes. Yes, I'd like to get married all over again if for no other reason than this.
James, thank you for calling.
Yes.
Hey, thanks so much, y'all. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Milk Street Radio. Sarah and I are ready to answer your culinary questions. Give us a ring anytime. Our number, 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843. Or you can email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Emma Whitlock from Columbus, Georgia.
How can we help you in the kitchen?
So I love to bake, and recently I decided that I wanted to try to challenge myself and start making macarons. I found two different types of recipes, the French style and the Italian style, and I've had mixed results. So I was wondering if there's one method that tends to have better results than the other one. And then if I find a recipe for one style, can I use that same ingredient ratio to make the other style, if that makes sense?
Excellent questions. And we don't know the answer. No. Well, I mean, the French style is egg whites and sugar, obviously whipped together. Italian style is egg whites with sugar syrup, which is heated, obviously, and drizzled into the whites as you beat them. You know, an Italian meringue, for example, I used as a frosting for cakes. It's pretty stable. So the Italian version gives you more stable meringue, which means when you fold in other ingredients, it's easier. The French method is simpler to do because you're not heating up sugar and water. But when you fold in the other ingredients, the foam is not as stable and you're more likely to disturb the foam. Is that a French pastry chef term? Disturb the foam. So French is easier. Italian's more stable. And then I think they're a little different. I think Italian meringue's probably a little more powdery. I think French meringues tend to be a little chewier to me, but that's just my personal take. Sarah, you're the French expert here.
Yeah, although I'm not really a big baker, but I agree with what Chris had to say. The French meringue is easy. You beat the whites. You know, sometimes you add a little acid to them, and then when they get foamy and start to get soft peaks, then you add the sugar and et cetera. So it's pretty simple. The Italian reminds me of a buttercream I used to make with my sister. This cake every year we used to make for my mother, and this will make Chris nervous, too, because he feels the same way about this cake. It was a Genoise.
Oh, no.
PTSD.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we
no.
hate that. We hate no. the Genoise. With this buttercream and then with praline.
The
and
cake the, that never turns out well.
Well, the cake that made us cry. That's right. What we call it. But the thing about the Italian meringue is you have to get the sugar syrup to a certain temperature between 235 and 240, which is soft ball stage. And then you have to drizzle it on top of the egg whites. And, you know, it can get caught in the beater. And so it is a little bit fraught. You know, the more you do it, the better you'll get. And it is more stable. The one thing I would say is I wouldn't take a recipe for one
no.
and use the method of the other. It just won't work.
Okay.
It's just not the same ratio of sugar. There's water in the one and not in the other.
Well, look, you're mixing French and Italian.
Right.
That just
well, I mean,
never
there
works.
There you go. There you
yeah,
go.
It's just not going to happen, especially when it comes to desserts.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to make your life easy, just do the French one. If you want to get a little more sophisticated, then I would continue working the Italian one.
I found with making Italian meringues, I do it a lot for cakes, getting it just the right temperature. I don't think it's not like making candy. It's pretty forgiving.
There's a range. Yeah.
The temperature is pretty forgiving. But, you know, try both and see what you like.
Okay. Instant rate thermometer, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's good to tilt the saucepan up so you get a good reading with the depth of the sugar syrup. And also take a reading in more than one spot.
Yeah.
Because it'll come up with a different temperature every time.
Yeah.
That's the fun of pastry work. by the way, so when you make your meringues, do they turn out well?
It's been mixed. Sometimes I've had some that turned out just great, and then other times I have them and they have, you know, the big holes in the middle of them. So I'm trying to kind of narrow down and figure out what my issues are.
I think anyone who makes meringues eventually has issues.
It's a challenging
thing. It's a challenge, but good for you.
Yeah, and the more you do it, the better you're going to get. We applaud you.
Okay.
And we'll eat your meringues anytime.
Yes. Okay, Emma.
Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You know, remember back in the 80s, you and I were kind of starting out in this field, and there was this, I don't think it was a Time magazine cover, but it was like, is cooking dead? Like, is God dead? Remember that? That was one of those themes. And now, 30, 40 years later, people are making meringues at home?
I know. No, it's crazy.
The answer is no. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, a new way to think about baking with Paul Hollywood. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White. And here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavor of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just want to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Most Your Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with Paul Hollywood. He's been a judge on the Great British Bake Off since it premiered in 2010. On the show, contestants compete for fame, glory, and a rare handshake from Paul, which is now known as the Hollywood Handshake. His new book is called Bake, My Best Ever Recipes for the Classics. Paul, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the Great British Bake Off. What is that actually like? In other words, what's the fun part of that show and what's the not so fun part that nobody actually sees?
I think I'll start with the not so good stuff is when you're forced to eat 36 bites of something that's extremely sweet. Even though it sounds amazing, you're filling yourself. You feel bloated. It's not a very nice experience. But having said that, I think ultimately being on the Bake Off is a real treat because to be paid to judge some of the most amazing bakes I've had during my time and meet some incredible bakers as well. It's obviously almost turned into a cult at the moment, the Bake Off. It's right. A strange sight when you first see it, because it's this colossal, and it is big, huge white tent looking like an alien spacecraft that's just landed in the middle of a field.
Okay, let's talk about baking. So you say that margarine, you use that with butter or instead of butter, like in a chocolate fudge cake. You think that gives you better texture overall?
Margarine can give you texture, gives you more of a flake, and butter gives you the flavor. I mean, butter tastes nicer than margarine or shortening, you know, obviously, because it's butter, it's the purest thing. Whereas margarine tends to give more of a flake, or lard actually is the other thing. I mean, you can make a great lardy cake, a very, you know, very old recipe using lard, and it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And it creates a flake, it creates a beautiful glisten, it creates a nice crunch. But then butter will add this gorgeous lusciousness to it and this richness to it, and obviously more flavor. And so it's horses for courses. I mean, certain recipes, it's nice to have just butter. Others, it's good to have just margarine. And then others, I like the idea of blending, because then you get the best of both worlds.
Weighing ingredients. You actually weigh your eggs, which is interesting, because here in the States, we rarely do that. We just say 6 large eggs. You find that egg sizes vary enough so that weighing them is actually critical?
I think it is. I think if you crack an egg, drop it in, normally weighs about 60 gram. You know, some of the small ones can weigh 50 or 40, and some of the large ones can be 70. Also, if you've knocked in 120 or 180 gram of egg into a bowl and you've whisked it up a little bit to break it up, you can easily add a little bit of a time to a mixture rather than a whole egg, 60 grams straight in, and then it could curdle. So I think doing it this way is more accurate and certainly safer.
In your scone recipe, which I guess was the Queen Mother's favorite, you use bread flour instead of all-purpose flour, and that's kind of interesting. Could you talk about that?
Well, that's because in my professional career, that's all I ever used for scone. So I never used the plain flour. So it actually creates more of a bloom in the oven. So it grows. And what it does is creates an amazing balanced growth, and it gives more of a kick. So it opens up the texture a little bit inside the scone. The thing is with that, when you're using strong flour, you cannot overmix it. Because if you overmix it, what will happen is it'll get too tight. And then it gets a bit rubbery on the mouth. So you want to be able to just bring it together and then cut, rest it for about 5-10 minutes in the fridge, preferably, and then pop it into a nice hot oven. And it just blasts up perfect level, and it's crispy and then beautifully soft on the inside.
So here's a quote from your book, Bake. Yeah. I can assure you that all the cookies in this chapter fully stand up to the dunk test. Why are you obsessed with dunking cookies?
It's a tradition in the UK to dunk your biscuits. And obviously, when I say biscuits, I'm talking cookie. But I love dunking a ginger nut or a ginger biscuit into tea, a very hot cup of tea. If you put it in once, that's enough. Then you eat it because it's beautiful and soft. If you put it in twice, you could lose it. And that's a problem. So ultimately, I love it's just been a thing. It's quite a big thing. I suppose it's only the Brits that do that, although the Italians do dunk
their biscotti.
Yeah, right. And the French with their croissant in their coffee.
Except it's hard to find a good croissant in Paris.
I think it's hard to find a good croissant anywhere nowadays. I think they've gone down the mass produced route now, which is all done in factories, and they throw them out to the little bakeries, and all they do is bake them off. And I think they've lost their way slightly.
Lemon drizzle cake is one of your favorites.
It is.
It's one of those things that I don't think we make here very much. So is this basically a drizzled pound cake or a sponge cake or what?
It is a sponge cake, basically, with a slightly watered down lemon curd, if you like, sugar mixture, which it gets put into the cake when it comes out the oven. And all you do is you pierce it and then let the soak drip through.
Right.
And it wets and introduces a more intense lemon flavor. And it also introduces a slightly sugar crust on the top of the cake. So as you break into it, we used to do it for afternoon tea for all the big hotels, you know, whether it's fruitcake, cherry cake, walnut cake, banana cake. And it was all with certain teas went with certain cakes. It was, you know, whether it's Lapsang Souchong or it was Assam or Earl Grey. And that's what it's all about. It's about getting the senses involved with some intense flavors and doing the lemon drizzle, which is a very classic British cake. It's been around for many, many hundreds of years. It is one of my favorites, and I love them.
Only the British would name a roll after a trash can lid, I think. So what is it with bin lids? I never heard of this before.
Well, basically, a bin lid is a large soft roll. So you can get soft rolls in the States, you know, the like burger buns, if you like.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Then a bin lid is 4 or 5 times bigger than that. And the way I grew up in Liverpool, in our chip shops, our fish and chip shops, you used to get, you could get a portion of chips and then you get what they call a bin lid. So you get this huge soft roll, which you can fill with lots and lots of chips and have the biggest chip butter you've ever had in your life. And it tastes amazing. And that's where it came from. It came back from my working class roots in Liverpool.
So, wait. So you have this huge roll and you fill it with chips?
Yeah, fill it with chips. Yeah. Chip butter.
There you go.
Yeah.
You guys, I mean, it's the best of times and the worst of times, right?
In absolutely, <British cooking>. Yes.
Let's go back to growing up. So you grew up above the bakery.
Yeah.
Your dad was a baker, and you did not want to go into that business, but he bribed you, which I guess was very effective. What was that like? What kind of bakery was it? You didn't like it. You did like it.
Oh, I loved it. I think the smell of a bakery, I think when you lived above it, it sort of seeped into your life. You know, it became part of you. My dad always coming back from the bakery from, you know, downstairs, upstairs, and he'd smell of bread and cakes. And I ended up coming into the industry, obviously, and I smelt like bread and cakes. But initially, I do remember sort of disappearing off and sitting in the shop with my mum, helping serving the bread and cakes. But it was great. I mean, you just wander up and pick up a cream cake and eat it.
But that's a, you know, one of my kids actually did this for a while. It's, if you want to pick a hard profession, getting up at 2 a.m,
know.
You know, it's not an easy life.
It's not.
So what was your conclusion after having your own bakery?
I think during the bakery times, I was approached for TV work because someone had put my name for, I think Sue Perkins had put my name forward for Bake Off. I was asked to do an audition, which I did, and fortunately I got the job. And in the end, I realized I couldn't do all this TV stuff and run my business at the same time. And I couldn't honestly sell my own bread under my name without me actually making it myself. And in the end, the Bake Off took over my life, and that is that middle ground. I'm still involved with my trade, but more as a teacher now, an evangelist, than I was, you know, as an actual baker.
What is your job at the Bake Off? In other words, what did you have to learn to get really good at it?
I think I've always been quite judgmental with the lads that have worked for me and guys that have trained up, who worked for me. And I was always on their case. I'd walk past the rack and say, what's happened with this one? So when it came to judging amateur bakers, that was fantastic. What's changed is it's more of a almost tutorial, because the bakers themselves, when you're critiquing their work, you're trying to offer advice on going forward, how they can better themselves in the kitchen. And I like to think that that does help.
Do you ever start giving advice and criticism and you see the tears welling up?
Yeah, all the time.
So some people don't take it too well.
All the time. And it's because sometimes you've got to think about from their point of view. Maybe all the people around them have never actually told them the truth about their baking. So maybe that recipe that they've been making for 10 years, if someone bakes you a cake and brings it to you, you're not going to turn around and say, that's the worst cake I've ever had in my life, or that's too salty, or that's too sweet. You know, because you're just glad someone's actually baked something for you and they think of you that much. They've made you something which you should appreciate, like it or not. In my job, I don't have to follow that rule. I have to be honest with them. And therefore, they end up getting a little bit better anyway. It's a learning process.
Once in a while, you must get surprised, right, by one of the contestants. Mm. Have there been cases where someone produced something absolutely amazing you didn't expect, or something so vile you wanted to spit it out after taking a bite?
Yeah, I'm both camps, yeah. I mean, fortunately, it's more sublime than the ridiculous. I think when I started shaking someone's hand, because I was genuinely surprised. I was really, wow, wow, that's incredible. That's almost professional. Do you know what I mean? So that's where I shook their hand and said, thank you, well done. You know, that's a great job. So some years I'll give more handshakes out, some years I won't. But it comes down to the quality of what's on that plate. And sometimes it is absolutely stunning.
If you had to pick one recipe, and I think your favorite's probably lemon drizzle cake, but is there one recipe you think should be part of everyone's repertoire here in the States?
Do you know what? I've always said lemon drizzle cake is a very basic cake. but actually it's not. In the sense of when you eat it, it's not a normal sponge. It's a very enriched, it's heightened, it's quite tart. It's full of lemon and it is absolutely delicious. And I'd love every American household to get it, improve it if they wish. Once you've mastered it, if you want to add a little bit of tangerine or maybe some other fruits in there or layers of apple in there, make it your own. Make it a family tradition.
Yeah, but then eventually someone's going to add rosemary to it or, you know, then you're off to the races.
Well, yeah, but I'd say if you like rosemary in it, you go for it. So,
Paul, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, thank you, Krista. You take care.
That was Paul Hollywood. His new book is called Bake. You can find his recipe for lemon drizzle cake at milkstreetradio.com. In 1938, Freddie Griswold hosted The Spelling Bee and became the very first game show host. The genre soon took off with To Tell the Truth, What's My Line, Let's Make a Deal, The Gong Show, American Idol, and today a dozen or more cooking competitions. But to attract a large audience, these competitions have to push the boundaries, from guys' grocery games to cutthroat kitchen. Bake Off, however, is a little more Dickens than YouTube. It's a kinder, gentler take on humanity. Or, as Vera Lynn once sang, they'll always be in England. This is Mill Street Radio. Coming up, J. Kenji Lopez-El teaches us how to cook outside with a wok. That's after the break. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to Milk Street Radio. Now let's chat with Lynn Clark about this week's recipe, spicy Chinese beef skewers. Lynn, how are you?
I'm doing well.
You know, one of the great pleasures in my life is interviewing interesting people on radio. You know, I spoke to Jason Wang, owner of Xi'an Famous Foods in New York. Great story. He has a great cookbook. And he was telling me when he was a kid in Xi'an with his dad, they go to the Muslim quarter and order meat skewers, spice meat skewers. And he really associates those flavors with the cooking of Xi'an. So you got busy, we got busy, and decided to make these spicy beef skewers at home.
So I think actually Jason said that when they would go to the Muslim quarter and buy these, they would buy them by the tens. So like 10, 20 at a time. So as you can tell, this is something you're going to want to make and want to make a lot of. The key to this recipe is pretty simple. It comes down to spicing twice. So we're going to coat them with some toasted spices. We toast all of those cumin seeds, Sichuan peppercorns, and fennel seeds, then grind them, add the pepper flakes and the salt. The meat takes a little bath in some soy sauce, some Shaoxing wine, and oil. We thread them onto the skewers and then coat it with the spice mixture. That gets cooked on a hot grill, takes literally like 5 minutes. It's the fastest thing you'll ever make. And then we coat it again with that spice mixture. So you're getting two layers of flavor. You've got the first round that gets kind of toasted when you cook it over the grill, gets a little bit of char on the meat. And then that second layer is a little bit fresher, a little brighter. Those peppercorns are really kind of mouth numbing, and you've got that really aggressive heat from the pepper flakes.
So this is a twofer. We often marinate a meat and then reserve part of the marinade before we use the rest of it on the meat. And then the marinade becomes the sauce at the end, right? So a similar concept.
Yeah, same kind of concept here. These are great tips for any kind of grilling. We're using flat iron steak here, which is one of my favorite cuts. It's very well marbled, cooks really fast, has a pretty decent amount of fat on it, which you should not trim away. We like that fat for the flavor and also for the richness. You could use the same method with the spice twice or marinade and reserve on chicken. You could use it on fish and certainly on beef or pork or lamb.
I need to give a commercial for Flatiron Steak now, if I could have 10 seconds. I hadn't had it in years. I bought it last weekend at a local butcher, and I just grilled it. I salted it, grilled it, you know, none of the fancy stuff you're doing. It was the best steak I ever had. It was unbelievably tender but flavorful. No, steaks are either tough and flavorful or tender and tasteless.
Yes.
This did both things really well. And Shaoxing wine is not something most people have on hand. It's not hard to find, but you could use sherry or something, I guess, as a substitute. Right?
And also, I know you say I'm doing fancy stuff here. This is not fancy stuff. This is a quick toasting of some spices and just kind of sprinkling it on. The whole recipe will take you maybe a half an hour at the most.
Lynn, thank you. Spicy Chinese beef skewers, inspired in part by Jason Wang's childhood in Xi'an. Excellent, as you said, quick meal. Thank you.
You're welcome. You can get this recipe for spicy Chinese beef skewers at milkstreetradio.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, Sarah and I will be taking a few more of your calls.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Alice Taylor from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi, Alice. How can we help you today?
Well, I had a question originally about lemon flavoring. I bake a old-fashioned buttermilk pound cake, and it calls for 2 teaspoons of lemon extract and 1 teaspoon of almond. And it just seems like it bothers me. Something in that I think is the lemon bothers me. And I was wondering if I could replace that with just pure lemon juice or lemon zest instead of the extract.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of lemon extract either. I guess it's made with lemon peels and alcohol, and I think it can be sort of bitter. But for whatever reason, I'm just not a fan of lemon extract, so I'd say ditch it. I agree with you. I am a huge fan of lemon zest. I add it to a lot of things, not even just baking things. I just think it's got it's sort of got the oil of the lemon from the skin, and it's got a ton of flavor, and it's very fresh. You can add a lot of it without screwing up the ratio of liquid. So I would say definitely add some zest to the recipe. And, you know, if you wanted to, you could add a little bit of lemon juice as well. And that would be fine.
Oh, good.
And also mix the lemon zest with the sugar in the recipe, which will help to bring out its flavor. I mean, it depends on how lemony you want the pound cake to be. But if you want it to be really lemony, mix the two together, and that will really help the sugar to pick up the oil from the zest.
Well, there's one other thing they make instead of extracts, their oils. I forgot the name of the company.
Boyajin,
yeah. And they make oils, and those are much better than the extracts.
Yes, they are.
And
you'll
get a better
about that
flavor.
Yes.
You might want to give
Boyajin
that a shot.
It's Boyajin or I-N.
But anyway, that's an alternative.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. If I add the oil, should I add the lemon zest too, or just Boyajin?
I would just use the Boyajin. You won't need the lemon zest.
Okay.
Just check online to see if it's an equal amount as extract, but my guess is it probably is, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Alice, it's thanks
really
for calling.
Nice
thank you.
Talking to you.
Yeah. Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Mill Street Radio. If you want to change the way you cook, just give us a ring anytime. Our number is 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or just email us at questions@millstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Adam Shatila from Philadelphia here at Walnut Street.
Oh, yes, Walnut Street. How can we help you today?
My family and I have like a Lebanese restaurant / bakery where you bake lots of, traditional Lebanese delicacies and treats and the like. We sell our baklava. I've been the manager for a few years now and trying to start something new by selling our baklava wholesale. We're in three smaller stores here, but I wanted to accelerate the growth and get into like a larger chain supermarket. And like, I was wondering if it's okay with you guys to offer some advice on how that to do that. And we're approved for wholesale. We have all the licensing and all that.
So you're trying to figure out how to sell your baklava in, say, a Whole Foods or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I might have to defer to Chris on this one because I've never...
I have a few thoughts about
this. Yeah, because Chris has been involved in some of this, so I'm going to pass it right
over.
Yeah,
a few years ago, we had coffee sugars. We had some products, and we were putting them into stores. There are two problems. The margins you get are slim. The grocery business is a very low-margin business. You usually have to go through a wholesaler, you know, or distributor into the stores. Everyone takes a piece of the action. It's a very difficult business.
Yeah.
And then you also have to be able to provide enough volume, you know, to make it worthwhile. A friend of mine went into the wine business years ago, and they were losing their shirts until they set up a little tasting room in their vineyard, and then they started selling it directly to the retail, to the customer. So I strongly suggest you find a way to sell it direct because you can control it. You make more money that way. If you get involved with supermarket distribution, I just found it a very unsatisfactory business because there's so many people involved and you make so little money. So, you know, in this day of e-commerce, I would go the direct route if I were you. Control your distribution yourself would be my quick business advice.
Sounds like good advice to me.
Well, I've been through it. And now we sell direct too. And I just think it's much better.
Right.
So,
Adam, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Thank you for the advice.
Thanks,
yeah,
Adam.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Next up, let's hear from J. Kenji Lopez Alt. Kenji, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. What's up?
So it's getting into summer, and I thought we could talk a little bit about some outdoor options for cooking in a wok and why you may want to consider cooking outdoors in your wok if you've got the space for it.
So is this cooking on a grill, or is this cooking on a butane burner, or what?
Yeah, so cooking on outdoor on a grill certainly is one option. First, you know, maybe we want to talk a little bit about why you might want to cook outdoors. There's a couple of reasons. So first of all, if you live in a house or an apartment that doesn't have a great vent hood, you know, like I lived in a New York apartment for many years, and we had these little galley kitchens where the vent hoods, all they did was recirculate the air back into your apartment. A couple of weeks ago, I was teaching a class in Seattle, all stir frying in a room with no ventilation at all. We were making Kung Pao chicken, and the moment all the chilies went into the pan, you know, pepper spray, essentially, everybody had to leave the room. If you run into that problem also, you might consider cooking outdoors. The other advantage, of course, of cooking outdoors is that if you have the right setup, you can actually get much higher heat. But even just having a portable butane burner, you know, there's a company called Iwatani that makes a 15,000 BTU portable butane burner.
Butane means one of those small bottles of butane?
Exactly, yeah, the little camp stoves.
And that has enough heat, really?
It does, yeah. You know, as long as you're not trying to do, you know, like a Cantonese-style beef chow fun, or you're not trying to cook for 20 people at a time, you know, those butane burners are great because they have small burners, which is exactly what you want for a wok, and it concentrates the heat right in the center, which allows you to stir fry properly.
When I was in Thailand years ago, everyone cooked with a 25-gallon propane tank hooked up to a burner, and that burner got really hot. Does that have high BTU?
So it depends on the burner. Yeah, so we can talk a little bit about outdoor burner options. You would think, you know, the higher the BTU output, the better it was going to be.
Right.
But what I found was that once you got above around 150,000 BTUs or so, so that's about 10 times more than your average home burner. You know, once you get up to this really ridiculous range, it's pointless. You know, things get incinerated the second you put them into the pan. And moreover, you know, part of the design of a good outdoor burner, especially when you're cooking with a wok, is the way the heat is concentrated. So these big turkey fryers that are designed to heat up a giant pot of oil like a crab boil or for frying a turkey, they actually spread the heat out too much. And so when you're trying to cook in a wok, you know, you really want the heat concentrated at the bottom. And instead, what happens is the flame goes up the sides and you burn your hands and you don't have any of the cool zones along the sides of the wok. So there's a company called Power Flamer that essentially takes restaurant-style wok ranges and sets them up so that people can use them at home with the proper regulator and stuff. And you just plug in a propane tank or a natural gas line. Or there's a brand called Eastman Outdoors that makes a burner called the Big Kahuna, which is 65,000 BTU. And that's ample. And that one is a little bit more slick. You know, it comes with nice legs that feel stable and all that stuff. So if you do want a restaurant style stir fry, which is not necessary, you know, but if you do want a restaurant style stir fry, those would be the two I recommend. And you know, we also talked a little bit earlier about cooking in a wok on an outdoor grill. So what I actually recommend is using a charcoal chimney starter, but flipping it upside down. So I've tried doing this in a regular chimney starter, set the normal way, you know. So I take out the grate for my charcoal grill, I fill up the chimney starter with coals, light it the way I normally would, and then put the wok on top. The problem is that when you put a wok on top of a chimney starter the normal way, there's no ventilation, and so you don't get that chimney effect anymore, and so all the coals end up going out. If you flip it upside down, the vent holes that are at the bottom of the chimney starter are now at the top, and so you're able to actually get that chimney action. So it pulls air through the bottom, it circulates up through the top, and it keeps the coals nice and hot during the stir fry. You know, it's a little bit more precarious than cooking on a dedicated burner because a chimney starter is not the most stable thing in the world. But, you know, if you do want to practice outdoor wok cooking and you want to get some really nice concentrated heat and you already have a chimney starter, it's a good way. It's a good way to do it.
So you have a 2-foot high flaming hot cylinder on which you put a large wok, and you say that's slightly unstable. Yeah, you want to be careful.
I recommend doing it like in a dry field.
That's a good idea, yeah. So I do have a question. So besides smoke, et cetera, are there things you would choose to use a wok for outside in the summer, regardless of what your indoor kitchen was like?
So, you know, again, dishes that feature that wok hei flavor, you know, that smoky flavor, where you really need a really high flame and you want to get that flame kind of leaping into the wok. You know, the classic example of that would be beef chow fun, right? Where the seasoning is very simple. It's a bunch of alliums and then soy sauce. But the major component of that seasoning is the smoke flavor itself, where you get the flame to leap into the wok and you're really searing the soy sauce as you add it to the wok. And those are flavors that are relatively easy to get. I mean, it still takes practice, but they're relatively easy to get when you have a very high output burner, but are difficult or impossible to do when you're talking about indoor cooking.
Could you be more specific about the flames leaping into the wok?
Yeah. You know, it's similar to the flavor you get when you're cooking a hamburger on a grill and a little bit of the fat drips down into the coals and you see like a little jet of flame come up and it deposits some soot on the food. And so that flavor, when applied properly and in moderation, adds that smokiness that you get from high heat wok cooking. So when I say, you know, the flame leaps into the wok, I literally mean you get your oil really hot, you put your noodles in there or your onions or whatever, you start stir frying them and you tilt the pan towards the flame. You tilt the wok down towards the flame as you're tossing food in the air with the goal of getting that flame to leap across all the little aerosolized droplets of oil and the flame to actually jump down into the wok. And so when you do it properly, you'll see the flame literally licking the inside of the wok. And as you're tossing the food through it, it goes through like little kind of like a fireball.
And if you do it badly, the next day you're living in an airstream.
Right.
Because you just burn your house down.
Yes.
Kenji, thank you. Taking your stir fry outside. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me as always.
That was J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. He's the chief culinary consultant for Serious Eats, a food columnist for the New York Times, also author of The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. That's it for today. We have over 200 episodes of Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, MilkStreetRadio.com, or wherever you find your podcasts. To explore Milk Street and everything we have to offer, please go to our website, 177milkstreet.com. There you can download our recipes, watch our television show, and check out our online store for everything from sitar to ginger graters. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimmel's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177 Milk Street. We'll be back next week with more food stories and cooking questions, and thanks as always for listening.
Christopher Kimmel's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH. Co-founder Melissa Baldino, executive producer Annie Sinzibah, senior editor Melissa Allison, producer Sarah Clapp, assistant producer Caroline Davis, with production help from Debbie Paddock. Additional editing by Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chewbop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.